bit sad for me anyway, getting the second last of the lectures. I've been enjoying myself. Today I want to talk about the Iliad in translation and translation as interpretation. I'd like to begin a bit differently from the other times with a little story. This is, and we'll come on to Christopher Logue later, so say something about that at the end of the lecture. And this is from a book by, before I do that, let me just give you my usual outline for the day. We're going to be looking at sort of examples of translations over the last couple of centuries. So an example of 17th century George Chapman, 18th century neoclassical Alexander Pope's famous Iliad translation, 19th century kind of biblical type translation, Lang, Leaf and Myers. In 20th century, I didn't quite know what to label it, but it's a sort of attempt at a kind of authentic, kind of oral type Iliad by Richmond Latimore, American translation, and then kind of postmodern reworking, really a kind of new version of parts of the Iliad by Christopher Lowe. Yes. Oh, me, on tomorrow. I'm giving a whole lecture to my translation. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm just conscious of... Anyway, I'll start telling about the little narrative I wanted to give you. It's from a book by Alberto Manguel. I'll put the details up in a moment. It's actually not a very good book, but I like... There's quite a lot of mistakes in it. But he's got a very nice anecdote at the beginning, how in 1990 in South America, the Colombian Ministry of Culture set up a traveling library system for remote areas, and they would fill saddlebags with books, put them on donkey back, and send the donkeys off into the remote jungles and the high sierras. The books would be left there for the villagers for several weeks, and then they would be collected and taken back again. There's the book, as I say. I wouldn't particularly recommend it, apart from this story. Manguel says, according to one librarian, the books were always safely accounted for. I know of a single instance in which a book was not returned, she said. We had taken, along with the usual practical title, because these were mainly kind of peasant villages, titles about agriculture and irrigation and so on. We took a Spanish translation of the Iliad. When the time came to exchange the book, the villagers refused to give it back. We decided to make them a present of it, but asked them why they wished to keep that particular title. They explained that Homer's story reflected their own. It told of a war-torn country in which mad gods mix with men and women who never know exactly what the fighting is about, or when they will be happy, or why they will be killed. I thought it was a great story. And there's just a couple of points I'd like to extract from that. I mean, one is the universal appeal of Homer's Iliad. Even when transported to a cultural context, you know, it's about as far as you could possibly imagine, removed from 8th century BC archaic Greece to the Colombian jungles. Also, the power of translation, in Spanish in this case, power of a different language to transport the Iliad in that way from one cultural context to a very different one. And it's not really part of that story, but the point I'd like to make also now is the fact that translations are first and foremost for those who don't know the original. Now, that seems a kind of trite point, but it's a strange paradox of this particular art form that it tends to be judged by people who do know the original. So you'll get Greek scholars who say, it shouldn't be like that, and why has it done that, and that, and that. But it's actually not meant for them. It's meant for people who don't know the original language and are meant to appreciate it in the language into which it's translated. Okay, as I've said, I'll be talking in this lecture specifically about translation of the Iliad into English. I was going to start with a little bit of theory, but actually looking through the lecture this morning, thought, nah, we'll cut that out. But I'd just like to leave you with one thought. I mean, for me, the most important point is that every translation is an interpretation. There's no such thing as a culturally neutral translation. Any translation, whether sometimes maybe unconsciously, often consciously, carries with it the presuppositions and assumptions of the cultural context and the time and place at which it's made. And that means that just as you're never going to have a final and definitive reading of a great work of art such as the Iliad, no one's ever going to say the final word about precisely how the poem should be understood and read. In the same way, you're never going to have a final, definitive translation of the poem. Every time and place will want to make its own translations. And as long as people are interested in the poem, that's going to carry on. Okay, that said, let's look at examples. If you go to Wikipedia and English translations of Homer, and Wikipedia lists over 120 translations just into English. That is admittedly of both Iliad and Odyssey, so 120 people known to whoever wrote that article have translated Homer into English. It includes two prime ministers of Britain, the Earl of Derby. William Gladstone was hugely interested in Homer. He wrote several volumes. He didn't translate the whole of the Iliad or Odyssey, but he did do some partial translations of the Iliad. And I found looking at that list that if you even got a local, very unlikely translator of the Iliad, John Herschel, the astronomer who came out to South Africa, and of course had his house at Feldhausen, where Grove Primary School is now, and spent several years in South Africa, he produced a translation of the Iliad, which was published in Cambridge in 1866. It's the first I'd heard of it. I've never seen it, so I don't know what it's like. Okay, what I want to do to be able to compare translations is I'll focus on a single passage. It's from near the beginning of Iliad Book 12, and it's a simile. It focuses on the Trojan hero Hector and his battle fury. Okay, this is a point where the Trojans are driving the Achaeans back, and Hector's battle fury is compared to that of a boar or a lion confronting hunters and their dogs. Okay, I'll first show you an absolutely literal, my literal translation. It's not the one that, not my published translation. This is just a literal line-by-line translation of the passage, so you can get just the kind of content. But the Argives, and we'll come back to that in a moment, subdued by the whip of Zeus, are contained, and I'll come back to the bits and square brackets later, are contained, held back at the hollow ships, afraid of Hector, strong deviser of flight. But he, that is Hector, as before, was fighting like a whirlwind, as when in among both dogs and huntsmen, a boar or lion turns, exulting in his strength, but they close ranks like a tower, and stand against him and throw spear after spear. But his noble heart never fears nor is afraid, and his courage kills him. Often he turns, testing the ranks of men, and wherever he attacks, the ranks of men give way. I guess that's 12 lines translated pretty literally. I'd just like to make the point about this, that, you know, there's some theorists like the novelist and scholar Vladimir Nabokov, who most famous as the author of Lolita. He said, translations have to be absolutely literal, word for word, even if you have the piles of footnotes surrounding the text. But actually, it's an illusion. There is no such thing as a literal word for word translation, because, you know, if we say of something in English, that's two words. Greek expresses that by a single word, changing the ending. There's no way you can translate that one word for one word. And even here, okay, you see Argives is one of the names that Homer uses for the Greeks, the Achaeans. In my own translation, I've simplified, I always call them Achaeans, but Homer most often calls them Achaeans. Sometimes he calls the Greeks Argives, Sometimes he calls them Danaans. So in this passage, it's Argives. There's another case where you can't be literal. Zeus, if you go, Zeus's name goes into the genitive of Zeus. Actually, it's like a different word. In Greek, it's Zeus, and then of Zeus is Dios. So again, you can't literally translate that. You have to do something else with it. And these little Greek words in brackets, they lend a kind of generalizing force to a statement. So where they're added to a statement, it means it's the sort of thing that generally happens. You know, almost impossible to get that in English. So I just want to make that point that, you know, even the most literal translation is not absolutely literal and word for word. There's always interpretation and changing of the original going on. Just want to comment also on this important, I mean, the point of the simile in a way, although, of course, the detail is, you know, there for its own sake as well, adds something to this image. The point is that the animal is surrounded by hunters and their dogs, and in the end, the animal's courage kills him. That's obviously a crucial point for Hector, because Hector's own courage in the end is going to kill him too. Not now, much later. But Homer slips this detail into the simile, even at this earlier point. Okay, our first real translation by George Chapman. It's really the first famous English translator of Homer. And this is, of course, the character that Keats was so impressed by on first looking into Chapman's Homer. I mean, probably most of you know that much of I traveled in realms of gold and many goodly states and kingdoms seen, and so on and so on. But he never really understood what Homer. Keats didn't know any Greek until I heard Chapman speak out loud and bold. So that's Chapman's Homer, that in which Keats first encountered Homer and was intoxicated by what he read. Chapman's translation, he did it in bits, but the whole thing was published in full in 1616. And that was the English standard translation of Homer for a whole century, until Alexander Pope's translation, pretty much exactly a century later. And Chapman's is a wonderfully vigorous version, as we'll see. It shows to the full a kind of Elizabethan, Jacobean intoxication with language and with rhetoric. It's not known quite how much Greek Chapman knew. He was probably working mainly from kind of Latin and French versions of the poem. But he probably had some Greek, but it's not known precisely what. Okay, how does he render that passage? And here the Greeks were pent, tamed with the iron whip of Jove, the terrors vehement shook over them by Hector's hand, who was in every thought the terror master of the field, and like a whirlwind fought, as fresh as in his morn's first charge, and as a savage boar or lion hunted long, at last with hounds and hunter's store, is compassed round, they charge him close and stand, as in a tower they had enchased him, pouring on of darts an iron shower. His glorious heart yet naught appalled, and forcing forth his way, here overthrows a troop, and there a running ring doth stay his utter passage. When again that stay he overthrows, and then the whole field frees his rage, so Hector wearies blows, and so on. Okay, you can see obviously it's a poetic translation. He uses a long line. Homer's line is a six-beat hexameter, so-called hexameter line with six beats. This is even longer than Homer's line. It's a 14er. It's basically the sort of da-dum, 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 da-dum. It's got a sort of jogging rhythm to it. Notice, of course, the use of rhyme. Okay, pent, vehement, thought, fought, bore, store, and so on. If ever you see a translation in rhyme, you know that that's the addition of the modern translator. Ancient poetry doesn't rhyme. There's no rhyme used there. So that's immediately, obviously, appealing to the taste of the time, whether rhyme is used or not, as it is here. Mainly, very can see why Keats was impressed by it. Occasionally there are bits that seem to be a little weak. Hunters, it just means lots of hounds and hunters, store, that's a rhyme with boards, a store of them, which in, I did go and look it up in the Oxford, it does mean just a lot of in Jacobean usage. Because he's got such a long line, it's 12 lines, the same as the original, I mean he can go more or less keeping to the same number of lines. Now notice he's dropped Argives, he thinks that's a bit obscure, so he calls them here the Greeks, so he just forgets about all these different names, just calls them Greeks. Very typically, as I said to you before, Homer tended to pass through a kind of Latin interpretation of his poems because Latin was so much better known than Greek. So he uses the Latin forms of the names. Oops. Not Zeus, but Jove, the Roman Latin version, Hector with a C. And that he persists right through with the Latin forms of the names. Notice the translation deviates, as all translations do in their own ways, from the original. I mean, the original had talked about the boar or lion exulting in his strength. He's not, doesn't seem to like that. He just says savage, okay, as a savage boar or lion. He paraphrases the lines that describe the Greeks' fear of Hector. There's nothing about them stampeding to their hollow ships. That's not in his translation. Strangely, he omits that vital phrase, and his own courage kills him, because you know that is actually an important part of the passage, but he leaves it out, which seems a pity in terms of its importance for the interpretation of Hector's situation. And really, the last three lines are pretty much a kind of rather free paraphrase of Homer. Okay, many translators, including myself, tend to use a shorter line, more like an iambic pentameter, a five-beat line. Our problem is kind of compressing the meaning. Chapman, using such a long line, he tends to sometimes kind of pad it out and expand it a bit, because his line is actually longer than Homer's. So the Greek just says, earlier, he was fresh as before. This becomes as in his morn's first charge. So it's kind of expanded that idea of just earlier. Also, he shows, I mean, this, as I said in an earlier lecture, this period really had very little kind of sense, historical sense, of the difference between their own time and an earlier time. So he's not really conscious that all these references to iron are actually inappropriate. They're not in the Greek. Becomes the iron whip of Jove. The Greek just says the whip. And there's also, he imagines the weapons of the time as being iron rather than bronze, which Homer is quite strict about. Okay, so that's Chapman. If we move on to Alexander Pope, I'll bring up the slide in a moment, but Pope, by contrast, had a good knowledge of Greek, so you know he no doubt consulted, and I'll show you a point where I'm pretty sure he did consult Chapman's translation. But he was able to work directly from the Greek. Pope is, of course, the prime representative of the so-called Augustan school of poetry, very neoclassical, prizes above all decorum, decorum being a sense of what is fitting, what's appropriate in language and style and tone to a particular subject matter. I mean, that's enormously important for poets of this period. And in general, prizing kind of calm and restraint and order and rationality, everything that the Romantic movement was going to kind of rebel against when they prized irrationality and emotion and disorder and so on. Okay, let's see what Pope makes of that passage. Smote by the arm of Jove with dire dismay, close by their hollow ships the Grecians lay. Hector's approach in every wind they hear, and Hector's fury every moment fear. He, like a whirlwind, tossed the scattering throng, mingled the troops and drove the field along. So amidst the dogs and hunters daring bands, fierce of his might a boar or lion stands. Armed foes around a dreadful circle form, and hissing javelins rain an iron storm. His powers untamed their bold assault defy, and where he turns the rout disperse or die. He foams, he glares, he bounds against them all, and if he falls, his courage makes him fall. Okay, so you can see very different in feeling and tone from Chapman's translation, still recognizably talking about the same things. But you'll immediately notice the absolute regularity of the form. Again, it's rhymed. These are rhyming couplets, so-called heroic couplets. Every line is precisely 10 syllables long, so each one is a kind of perfect iambic pentameter. But Pope was a complete master of that form, so he very seldom becomes tedious or too regular. He constantly varies within that very strict form. So the movement, obviously, with the couplet, each couplet is a kind of sense unit. So it's a sort of pause, start, pause, start, pause. It's a kind of movement, couplet by couplet. You'll notice that there's quite strong punctuation at the end of every couplet. So colon, full stop, colon, semicolon, colon, full stop. So there's a definite pause at the end of each couplet, which is, again, very different from the movement of Homer's line, but obviously appealed hugely to Pope and his contemporaries. Because he's composing a shorter line, he slightly expands. Here we get 14 lines for 12. Again, notice it's very Latinate. Jove, he too takes the same line as Chapman and simply calls the Greeks. He often calls them Greeks in his translation. Here he wants a two-syllable word, so it's Grecians instead of Greeks. But he does use Greeks as well, too. You've got the rather decorous Grecians. Again, he seems to find the idea of the supreme god using a whip undecorous. So instead it's the arm of Jove. You know, that sounds a bit more appropriate to the supreme god. As we've seen, he has Grecians, not Argives or Greeks. Number of details don't correspond to the original, particularly the second last line. I mean, there's nothing really like that in the passage that we looked at. Also, in keeping with Pope's idea of decorum, each noun must receive its appropriate adjective. So you get dire dismay, and you get dreadful circle over there, daring bands. Where's that? A little bit above. Hissing javelin. And iron storm. I think he's picked that up from Chapman, because again, it's why does he bring that in at that particular point? This, again, rather unhistorical notion of iron weapon, which is at that point Chapman had used iron as well. And most interesting to me, and very characteristic of Pope's translation, is the way he handles that idea, and his courage kills him. As I said, Pope likes to, compose not only in couplets, but in a kind of verse paragraph, which has a kind of neat and strong sense of closure. So he takes that idea, which should actually, of the animal's courage killing him, which is so important for this passage, which had come in at about this point in the original, and he uses it as the closing idea of this whole description. So, and if he falls, his courage makes him fall. So it throws that important phrase into relief, that phrase that Chapman had simply left out. Okay, but Pope's was a very bold and creative translation, and it was hugely successful. It's probably the first and one of the few Homer translators in history has actually made money out of his translation. His translation did extremely well, went through numerous editions, kind of set him up for life as a poet. And let's say for at least another 100 years, this displaced Chapman. It was now seen as rather uncouth and crude, and so on. This was Homer for pretty much the whole 18th century. I just thought I'd show you one of the designs done by the neoclassical artist John Flaxman for Pope's translation, often reprinted with the translation. You can see they fit perfectly, again, the same sense of restraint and decorum. The human figures are like statues almost, like classical statues. Unmoved, calm, restrained, we just get this dignified gesture. The only kind of wild, slightly emotional motion is given over to the horses. And even there, it's pretty restrained. This one is sort of tossing its head slightly and lifting its front foot. This is from very near that passage we looked at, where Polydamas advises Hector that they should actually go back into Troy, but Hector won't listen. Okay, some of the contemporary reactions. Samuel Johnson called this a performance which no age or nation could hope to equal. Perhaps, nice for Pope, but one would hope that as things change, other translations might challenge Pope's. But Pope's is really, it's in some ways a kind of original great poem based on Homer, so it will last in its own right. As usual, the greatest Greek scholar of the day and the professor of Greek at Cambridge, Richard Bentley, was a very difficult character. As usual, the Greek scholars were a bit nitpicking. Bentley said, "It's a pretty poem, Mr. Pope, but you must not call it Homer." So, that was the scholar's response. Okay, moving on from 18th to 19th century. Now, you might expect with the 19th century, with very powerful orientation towards the past. If you think of Victorian architecture, for example, you get neo-Gothic after neo-Victorian Gothic building. There was this kind of obsession with the past, particularly the Middle Ages, and with the Gothic as they interpreted it. And you would expect that a culture so much oriented towards the medieval, towards the past, that it would stress the archaic element in Homer. The fact that Homer's poems themselves look towards a distant past. And for the Greeks, a couple of centuries after Homer, Homer's language seemed very archaic. Just remember that Greeks, just after the time of Christ, were separated by more than half a millennium from Homer. He was as distant, more distant than Chaucer is from us now. So you might expect that the 19th century would pick up on that element of the archaic in Homer. As far as Homer translation is concerned in the 19th century, perhaps the most important figure is the poet and critic Matthew Arnold. He wrote a book that was hugely influential later rather than in his own time, a book called On Translating Homer, which was a book version of lectures that he gave as professor of poetry at Oxford in 1861. And in a famous passage of that book, On Translating Homer, Arnold argued that there are four qualities of Homer that a translator had to represent. Okay, so this is the passage. Arnold writes, "When I say the translator of Homer should above all be penetrated by a sense of four qualities of his author," then you get this long parenthesis. Okay, so what must the translator be penetrated by? The fact that Homer is eminently rapid. Okay, rapid. He is eminently plain and direct, both in the evolution of his thought and in the expression of it, that is, both in his syntax and in his words. That he is eminently plain and direct in the substance of his thought, that is, in his matter, his subject matter and ideas. And finally, that he is eminently noble. Okay, when he says that, I probably seem to be saying what is too general to be of much service to anybody, but he's going to say it anyway. I would agree with almost all of that, and I've certainly, in my translation, striven towards that, except 20th and 21st century has a bit of a problem with noble, as I'll come back to in a moment. And I would also kind of take issue with it, just to the extent that Homer's style is actually not always rapid and plain and direct. Sometimes it's more highly wrought. I would say this is particularly true of the narrative, all the narrative passages of the poem. But some of the speeches, particularly the speeches of Achilles, are sometimes very wrought, quite difficult, and not always plain and simple and direct, reflecting the kind of tortuous thought processes of Achilles as he's trying to kind of come to grapple towards a new sense of what constitutes honor, as we saw yesterday. And the full influence of Arnold would really only be felt in the 20th century. To Victorian translators who wanted to bring out the archaic element in Homer, it seemed very natural to use an archaic, biblical-type English in their translations. And one of the best-known 19th-century versions is that by the classicists Lang, Leaf, and Myers. Some of you may know Andrew Lang. He published lots of books of myths and fairy tales, the Red Fairy Book and Blue Fairy Book and so on. He wrote a great deal besides classical scholarship. He was a very popular writer. Their translation is in prose, perhaps also because of the biblical influence, perhaps because Bible biblical narratives are in prose. They felt prose was also appropriate for what they were doing, even though the original was a poem. And there had been prose versions before, but they tend to become more frequent now, after this one, on into the 20th century. Okay, let's have a look. "The Argives, subdued by the scourge of Zeus, were penned and driven in by the hollow ships in dread of Hector, the mighty maker of flight. But he, as aforetime, fought like a whirlwind. And as when among hounds and hunting men a boar or lion wheeleth him about, raging in his strength, and these array themselves in fashion like a tower and stand up against him, casting many javelins from their hands, but never is his stout heart confused nor afraid, and his courage is his bane. And often he wheeleth him about, and maketh trial of the ranks of men, and wheresoever he maketh onset, there the ranks of men give way." Okay, again, completely different from Chapman, completely different from Pope. I mean, this is a translation by excellent Greek scholars. It's very scholarly, it's very accurate. And I think it has a kind of strength and integrity of its own. It was also hugely popular. It's reprinted dozens of times. But you can see now, for the first time in the translations we've looked at, there's a kind of conscious effort to make the text seem a bit more remote from the standard English tradition. Notice now, for the first time, the Argives are called Argives, and not Greeks or Grecians. Zeus gets his own Greek name. But this only goes so far. Hector is still spelt in the Latin way. So it's almost like a transition between it's Hector spelt with a C rather than a K in Greek style. So they're clearly trying to make it look a bit stranger and a bit more remote in time than those earlier translators, but they only go so far in that respect. Obviously, what stands out is the biblical language, the kind of and narrative, which actually reflects quite closely Homer's narrative style, which is very paratactic. It arranges one element one after the other. You don't get much subordination of the syntax in Homer. So you get that aforetime and in fashion like and wheeleth him about and maketh onset. And it must have had been thrilling for a Victorian readership. Okay, literary translation has changed so much in the last 100 years that this kind of archaism just now seems impossible in translation. And there's also the point that whereas the Bible would have been thoroughly familiar to Leif Lang and Myers as readers, that certainly can by no means be assumed of readers of Homer translations nowadays, which would be another reason why they might not favour this kind of translation. Okay, going on to the 20th, 21st century, just as in earlier periods, the English translations of the last 100 or so years have also been heavily influenced by the literary currents of the time, by modernism, even by postmodernism. Early in the 20th century, you find young writers in revolt against Victorian values, and particularly after what they saw as a kind of bloody and pointless conflict of the First World War. It was a huge kind of gap, generation gap, between their Victorian elders and the younger generation of writers. And to some extent, that's repeated after World War II, if you think of the kind of angry young men of the 60s also reacting against what they see as the blimpish, colonel-like elders who they felt still ruled Britain at the time. And to this younger generation, really after both wars, Victorian notions of idealism and nobility seem just fraudulent, hypocrisy, kind of fine words masking actual, warmongering and profit-making. Now, Homer translators in this period naturally saw the Trojan War through the lens of the conflicts that they experienced, World War I, World War II. I've got a poem by Patrick Shaw Stewart, wasn't very famous poet, but this poem became famous. He was kind of typical of an English elite at the time, Eton, Oxford, a brilliant Greek scholar, and went to war and died young in the First World War. You can see from his dates, 1888 to 1917, so what does that make him, 29? And this, these young, classically educated scholars going out, particularly, he went to Gallipoli, the Dardanelles, they kind of saw themselves as refighting the Trojan War in the same arena where that earlier war was fought. They were among the same landmarks. So he says, Achilles came to Troyland and I to Chersonese nearby. He turned from wrath to battle, and I from 3 days' peace. Was it so hard, Achilles, so very hard to die? Thou knowest, and I know not, so much the happier I. I will go back this morning from Imbros, the island near Troy, from Imbros o'er the sea, stand in the trench, Achilles, flame-capped, and shout for me. So he's alluding there to the moment in Iliad Book 18, when Achilles goes back to the fighting but has no armor, and he appears at the trench and shouts, gives a mighty shout, and the enemy drop back and fire plays about his head. So that's the illusion at that point. And then if you look at, this is a very popular American translation published in 1997. He's seeing, at least the editor, they're seeing the kind of landing at Troy with a seaborne force coming over from the Greek mainland, pouring their warriors onto the beach. It's kind of assimilated to the Normandy landings. And Stanley Lombardo, the translator, he kind of takes on a kind of tough guy voice. His soldiers speak very kind of bluntly, crudely, as real soldiers would. Okay, so as I've indicated, 20th century translators of Homer, influenced by the spirit of their time, generally jettisoned the notion that one should strive after nobility, but they eagerly seized on Matthew Arnold's other characteristics of being plain and rapid and direct. They greatly prized those characteristics. So we get E.V. Rieu's famous Penguin prose translations of Homer, done into a rather colloquial, stripped-down, very simple, plain form of standard English. And George Steiner, in his book Homer in English, I think justly comments on E.V. Rieu. He says, quote, "Denounced by some as the Agatha Christie version of Homer, E.V. Rieu's rendition has become dated by its very contemporaneity." In other words, it appealed so much to its own time, it was so contemporary, that it has dated precisely because of its success, in a way, because of its direct, simple quality. Now, as we saw in the first lecture, from the 1950s onwards, the effect of the scholarship of Parry and Lord became felt, and scholars gradually became convinced that Homer had been in some sense an oral poet, and this began to leave its mark on translations of Homer. That translators felt obliged to bring out the force of Homer's repeated noun-epithet combinations, quick-footed Achilles, Hector of the gleaming helmet, in Corsi, Lord among men, Agamemnon, and so on. And they felt obliged to pay more attention to the exact repeats of passages, such as when people arm or sacrifice is made, the same form of words is used. If you look at Pope, he is not interested in repeating the passage word for word. He'll elegantly vary it in the second occurrence, whereas now translators really feel they have to be more authentic, in a sense. And at the same time, Homer, the conception of Homer rather changes. Instead of him being conceived of as a kind of lofty court bard or biblical prophet, he turns into something more like a clan or village poet, something rather humbler and smaller scale. Still great, but seen in a different way. A poet singing the glories of a vanished time in humbler circumstances. Okay, I want to look at just one 20th century translation, that by Richmond Lattimore, which was first published in 1951 in America. And it really has been the standard Iliad for students for almost a generation, not only in America, but in Britain, South Africa. I've taught from Lattimore many times in my earlier career. Prose translations had tended to be in the majority in the decades before Lattimore, Penguin translation and others. So his translation actually marks a return to poetic translation. He's going back, in a sense, to the tradition of Chapman and Pope and translators like them. Lattimore, in a characteristically 20th century way, he quotes Arnold and he says, yes, rapid, plain, direct, that's good. But then I quote, he says, "I do not think nobility is a quality to be directly striven for. You must write as well as you can and then see whether or not the result is noble." And I would very much endorse that. Okay, this is Lattimore. "The Argives, broken under Zeus's lashing, were crowded back on their hollow ships and struggled to get clear in dread of Hector, the strong one who drove men to thoughts of panic. But Hector, as he had before, fought on like a whirlwind, as when among the pack of hounds and huntsmen assembled, a wild boar or lion turns at bay in the strength of his fury, and the men, closing themselves into a wall about him, stand up to face him and cast at him with the volleying spears thrown from their hands. And in spite of this, the proud heart feels not terror, nor turns to run, and it is his own courage that kills him. And again he turns on them, trying to break the masked men, and wherever he charges, the masses of men break away in front of him. He translates line by line, so 12 lines for 12 lines. He uses a long 6-beat line, which is pretty much the same sort of length as the line of Homer, sometimes a little bit longer. As you'd expect of a 20th century translator, even in poetic form, rhyme is abandoned. There's no longer, you know, after a whole century of free verse, unrhymed free verse, you're not going to, well, not a, at his time, half a century, you're not going to get a translator using rhyme. And also, because of the striving for authenticity, there's no rhyme in the original, so we're not going to use rhyme in his translation. Okay, because Lattimore uses a long line, flexible 6-beat line, like Chapman also using a long line, he sometimes, tends to pad out kind of unnecessarily. For example, you know, he adds that a pack of hounds and horsemen assembled don't really add anything to the idea. In fact, if you dropped it, you get a very nice iambic line, as when among a pack of hounds and huntsmen assembled. But he needs his 6-beat lines, he has to stick in something else there. And occasionally, there's the phrase used of Hector. In the Greek, you've got three words: strong, master, of the rout, all being one word in Greek. So three words. Lattimore expands that hugely here. The strong one who drove men to thoughts of panic. So three words become 10. And to me, the last bit of this line is terribly prosaic. The masses of men break away in front of him. I mean, it's, again, I think he's just trying to fill out his lengthy line. He could, I mean, the Greek simply says, wherever he charges, the masses of men give way or retreat. But he needs to get in his 6 beats. Notice now that the translator wants to go back beyond the long English poetic tradition to something authentically old and Greek. So we get the full suite here. Argives, not Greeks or Grecians, Zeus, not Jove, and now Hector with a K, not with a C, so a kind of Greek-type version of the names. Also, I think occasionally Lattimore, I mean, it's in many ways a great translation, it's certainly been extremely successful for its time. Occasionally he seems to me to the register of the language kind of changes quite abruptly. I mean, you get a very prosaic phrase like, and in spite of this, then you get the kind of very poetic inverted phrase, the proud heart feels not terror, which has a kind of Victorian sound to it. And he occasionally tends to do that. Kind of the register changes rather abruptly, perhaps deliberately. Not sure. Our next poet certainly changes register very deliberately, as we'll see. I promised in the course outline to say something about the Iliad versions of Christopher Logue, collectively known as War Music, which were published over 40 years, from 1963 to his death in 2005. This is the Logue. The first part of War Music was published in 63, the last part in 2005. I'm sorry, I think he died in 2008, actually, so... 11, I wasn't that glad. Glad he's familiar to his audience. He was a remarkable, he was a journalist, a poet, he wrote for Private Eye for decades, the true stories of Private Eye he used to do. Okay, so War Music consists of Patrick Leah, 1963. And each of these is a kind of loose version of a part of the Iliad. He often brings in parts from elsewhere as well, so sort of loosely. Iliad 16, War Music, 1981, Iliad 1-4, and incorporates a lot of Patrick Leah here, 16-19. Then Kings and Accounts of Books 1 and 2 of Homer's Iliad, obviously, which party is using there, 1991. The Husbands, books 3 and 4, the Iliad. All Day Permanent Red, it's a kind of collage of Iliad battle scenes. And then Cold Calls, the last part, War Music Continued. I've got his dates up there on the picture. War Music Continued in 2005, based again on the battle scenes of Book 7 and 8. Now, it's hard to characterize these wonderfully original texts. They're not translations in any conventional sense. Loeb didn't know any Greek at all, and he's quite frank about it. He says so in his introduction. He worked from a number of English versions, and he consulted with Greek scholars when he needed help. One of them was my former tutor in Greek at Oxford, Jasper Griffin. He's a great scholar of Homer. Loeb consulted with him about his version. And Loeb, he invents new characters and not in the Iliad. It's kind of exotic names like Kilaborak and Telespiax, and some character called Boy Luti that he brings in, who's Hector's charioteer. He also creates new similes on the Homeric model. So he's very creative. He creates his own similes, sometimes based on Homer, sometimes on his own poetic notion. So War Music really constitutes a series of original postmodern leaning poems based on the Iliad, a kind of rewriting of the Iliad as it might have been written by someone who'd been through the world wars of the 20th century. It's been a huge success with critics, even Greek scholars this time have kind of woken up to the fact that versions don't need to be entirely literal. And with the poetry reading public as well. Yeah, you can see from the cover of War Music the kind of way it's going. I mean, this is a new universal Homer aimed as much at the so-called third world as at Europe and the first world. It's clearly a deliberately chosen African warrior on the cover of his book. So it kind of brings us rather neatly full circle from the Colombian peasants of the beginning of the lecture to Loeb's conception of the warriors of the Iliad. Okay, the first passage, I'd like to look at two passages. The first is from Loeb's version in Patroclea of the start of Iliad Book 19, where Achilles' mother Thetis brings him his new armor made by Hephaestus. And as she laid the moonlit armor on the sand, it chimed, and the sounds that came from it followed the light that came from it, like sighing, saying, "Made in heaven." And those who had the neck to watch Achilles weep could not look now. Nobody looked. They were afraid, except Achilles, looked, lifted a piece of it between his hands, turned it, tested the weight of it, then spun the holy tungsten like a star between his knees, slitting his eyes against the flare, some said, but others thought the hatred shuttered by his lids made him protect the metal. You like? Good. I mean, you can see that this is a free rendering on the model of Homer. You can see the kind of modern free verse shape of the verse, of the lines on the page. The very 20th century shifting of levels of discourse, so you get the very poetic, beautiful, moonlit armor, chiming, and then very deliberately banal, made in heaven, like a manufacturer's stamp.
Made in China.
Yeah, well, that's clearly meant to be the level of the point, that this is like a manufacturer's stamp on the weaponry. Also, the deliberate use of anachronism, which you find throughout, kind of to shock us into constantly having to shift between the idea of Homer's archaic Greece and a very modern contemporary warfare. So you get the tungsten, obviously did not exist in Homer's time. And we'll see in the next one Loeb seems to exaggerate and intensify this kind of thing as he goes on with his versions of war music. Okay, the next bit is from Iliad Book 5, Diomed. He calls him, as many English writers do, Diomedes wounds the god Aphrodite. Okay, he's fighting against Aeneas, the Trojan champion, who is the son of the goddess Aphrodite. Diomed found and threw a stone as heavy as a cabbage made of lead that hit and split Aeneas' hip. As Diomed came to lop his top, Aeneas' mama, Aphrodite, dressed in grey silk lounge pyjamas, piped with gold and snakeskin flip-flops, stepped between him and the Greek. A glow came from her throat and from her hair, a fragrance that betokened the divine. Stooping, she kissed him better, as Queen Hera whispered, "Greek, cut that bitch." And Diomed, you did, nicking love's wrist. So, I don't think you need me to point out the constant variation in level there between flip-flops and cut that bitch and a deliberately kind of high poetic, a fragrance that betokened the divine. Loeb tends to consist, I think his point about dressing up Aphrodite like this, we saw how Homer, when he shows the gods interacting among themselves, tends to stress their frivolity and their almost childlike quality. And Loeb makes them behave that way as well in relation to human beings. The gods are consistently spiteful and vindictive and awful in Loeb's version. And I think that's why he has Aphrodite, like some kind of lounge vamp of the 1920s. And here is, again, sort of crude, vindictive wish for him to attack, because Hera, of course, is on the Achaean side. She wants him to attack Aphrodite, the champion of the Trojans. Okay, that's the last version of Homer I've got to say talk about today. I'll talk about my own translation and tomorrow. So I hope I've shown that there's no such thing as a culturally neutral translation any more than there can be a culturally neutral work of literature, and that every translation is an interpretation of another text, and it's shaped and influenced by its time and place and culture. Thank you. I know it's taken a bit long, but if there are questions, I'm happy to try and engage with them. Any? Yes.
Rhea's translation must be about the same time in the 1950s.
Yes.
The American one.
Yes.
Surely Rhea is much less pretentious.
Yes. Lattimore, I wouldn't say it's pretentious. He's also kind of generally quite plain. I sometimes think with Lattimore, if he actually wrote out his lines continuously, it would be hard to tell that they were poetry. He's often quite prosaic, and the beat is quite plodding. And I think if you wrote it as prose, it would actually be quite difficult to tell the difference. But yeah, you know, it's probably that both of them are trying for a certain sort of authenticity. Actually, Christopher Lowe had a wonderful phrase about E.V. Rhea. He called his translation mid-Edwardian steady. he thought it was a kind of Edwardian parlor type language. It's full of my dears and. Yes, there was a question.
Yes,
the comment was a comment rather than a question, that if you go to Troy, you must make take the time to go to Gallipoli. I'm afraid I didn't when I was part of a group when we went. I didn't get to Gallipoli. And it was remarked that you get very strongly the sense of connection between the kind of two wars of at Gallipoli and in Troy. Yes?
Do you find that it's very difficult if there is a larger vocabulary in one language than another? I live in France.
Yes.
I thought that perhaps I didn't speak French well enough because there is no word in France for a particular thing. You have to translate
it. Le smoking or le weekend.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, sir. Well, Homer actually has quite a rich vocabulary. I mean, you know, the difficulty with reading Homer when you're a kind of young Greek student of ancient Greek is that it's an archaic form. So, I mean, you normally learn the Greek of Athens of the 5th century BC and you battle your way to try to get some kind of grip on that. Then you're thrown into Homer, whose language is several hundred years earlier, full of archaic, different forms. But in fact, once you get used to it, of course, there are all these repeated elements, which are, when you're sort of battling to construe a bit as a student, okay, wonderful, repeated passage, Zeus tells sleep, go and tell Agamemnon A, B, and C, and then sleep comes to Agamemnon and says, do A, B, and C. We've already translated them. So it's quite a rich vocabulary, and I didn't find and English is so rich that I don't have the words for it, or there are more words in English that I would like to use but can't. Yes.
Seems rather sad.
Yes.
Who wrote Achilles in the Trench would appear to have died during the First World War.
Yes, 1917.
1917.
Apparently he was at Gallipoli but didn't die there. He died in a later engagement. So I think this poem was published at the time of Gallipoli, and then, which I think was early on in the war, wasn't it? And then he only died in 1917, so towards the end of the war. Okay.